Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Monday, July the 1st, these are our main stories. History in the making as Donald Trump steps into North Korea. Pro-democracy protesters challenge Sudan's military rulers for the first time since security forces shot dead dozens of civilians last month. And 50 years on from these Stonewall riots, millions of people take part in New York's Pride Festival. Also in this podcast, electric car makers discover that silence isn't always golden, and the American state kicking back against moves to restrict abortion rights. He once threatened to bomb North Korea, but on Sunday, in a highly symbolic moment, Donald Trump became the first serving US president to set foot on North Korean soil. He was invited to cross the border with South Korea shortly after meeting the North's leader, Kim Jong-un, who returned to the South with Mr. Trump. They agreed to set up new negotiating teams aimed at restarting talks on North Korea's denuclearization. It was a meeting organised at short notice after President Trump suggested they say hello via Twitter on Saturday. Our correspondent Laura Bicker, who's on the Korean border, followed the day's events.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Donald Trump didn't just take one step into what is officially hostile territory. He took 20. He shook the hand of Kim Jong-un before stepping over the military demarcation line which separates the two Koreas. Together they walked north before stopping, smiling, shaking hands once again, and then heading back south. Both leaders were aware that this meeting, hastily arranged via the US President's Twitter feed, was making history.
President Trump has just walked across the demarcation line that made him the first US president to visit our country.
I just want to say that stepping across that line was a great honor. A lot of progress has been made. A lot of friendships have been made, and this has been in particular a great friendship. So I just want to thank you. That was very quick notice, and I want to thank you.
Mr. Trump acknowledged that if Mr. Kim had said no to the last-minute proposal, it would have made him look bad. He went on to praise Mr. Kim for turning up and invited him to visit the White House. The meeting was supposed to be just a simple handshake, but both men went beyond what was billed. Talks, which were scheduled to last just a few minutes, took nearly an hour. There was a lot of talk about personal chemistry, but very little mention of the North's nuclear programme. Washington and Pyongyang have agreed to hold further discussions in the next few weeks. This is yet another fresh start. The hope here in South Korea is that this time it won't be a false one.
Laura Bicker. So what was the response to the meeting in the South Korean capital, Seoul? These locals watched the events on TV.
As a citizen of this country, I am so pleased to see the dialogue that went well. I hope for the best. Also, the leaders of North Korea and the United States and my country will work together and be connected with good works. I have a hopeful vision of them working as friendly countries.
Everyone all around the world knows that Korea is a divided country. Even though this meeting was not official but unexpected, we welcome it. I hope the denuclearization of the Korea Peninsula will be achieved and we can come a step closer to the unification of our divided country by taking this as a momentum.
Some thoughts from South Korea. So, was this, as President Trump said, a great day for the world or little more than political theatre for the world's press? Our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Michael Bristow, gave me his assessment.
President Trump, when he first came into office, was calling Kim Jong-un all kinds of names, including Little Rocket Man. It's only in the last year or so, since he decided he wanted to meet him, that in actual fact he's pushed up this chemistry idea. They've met just three times. It's not a relationship that's been built up over years and years and years. So perhaps that's over-egging the pudding a little bit. There certainly is something to it, though, because President Trump puts great store by meeting people personally. He thinks he can cut through all the morass of bureaucracy that previously has meant problems haven't been resolved. So he certainly thinks he can do that. But on the real test of this will be, can he do it? Can he bring about denuclearization in North Korea? And as of yet, he hasn't done it. So I suppose the chemistry hasn't worked yet.
So not necessarily a fresh start then?
Well, it is a fresh start in some respects in that they've both agreed to set up new negotiating teams. But that again almost seems like a backward step because they did have negotiating teams previously. Kim Jong-un got rid of his team when they didn't do so well following the last meeting between President Trump and Mr. Kim in Hanoi. So they're having to start again at the very beginning, so to speak. So Mr. Trump presented this as a step forward, but in actual fact, you could say it's a step back to the beginning. They're no further along the road of getting rid of nuclear weapons in North Korea, and sanctions still remain on North Korea. They haven't got rid of those sanctions. So there's not a lot of actual progress.
Is this really proof that you shouldn't try and organise summits with 24 hours notice?
Well, it's the kind of thing that President Trump likes to do. He likes to cut through the bureaucracy. He thinks that he can personally push things forward. But a lot of people are saying, well, actually, what you've done is you've given Mr. Kim a publicity coup. He's going to go back to North Korean people and say, look, I'm feted on the world stage by the world's greatest leader. And he hasn't had to actually do anything yet towards giving up his nuclear weapons. Meanwhile, you've got President Trump threatening Iran with a very similar thing, trying to stop them get nuclear weapons. What you get, I think, is that President Trump is backing himself into a corner. He's declared his relationship with Kim Jong-un to be a success. So now, therefore, if it isn't a success, it's going to be very difficult for him to back away from that. So lots of people think he's painting himself into a corner, and actually he hasn't played a very good hand.
Michael Bristow. To Sudan next, where mass protests against the ruling Transitional Military Council have taken place in cities across the country. As we record this episode, the Sudanese authorities say 7 people were killed and nearly 200 injured during the renewed protests. They marked the largest day of action since a deadly raid by security forces on a protest camp in the capital, Khartoum, 3 weeks ago. Huda is one of the activists in Khartoum.
More and more and more marches are happening, like all generations, all ages are coming out. Just recently, less than 30 minutes ago, in one of the main streets in Khartoum, like 3 pickups belong to the SRF, used real bullets to dismantle people, and then they left right away, and people are back now.
I asked our correspondent Mohamed Hashim from BBC Africa for the latest.
It's very interesting that at a speech made this afternoon, the deputy head of the Transitional Military Council, General Mohamed Hamdan Haimeti of the Rapid Support Forces, said that there were some snipers who opened fire at some of his forces. Now, that could be understood as either a threat that the security would take a heavy-handed approach moving forward, or that it was an attempt of him to sort of like dissuade the protesters from being on the streets, convincing them that there are some infiltrators amongst them.
How are the protesters managing to organise themselves? Because the internet's been switched off, hasn't it?
Yes, the internet has been off for the last 3 weeks. I was in Khartoum last week and I saw firsthand how these people are trying to mobilise. You have senior figures within the Pro-Democracy Alliance going on to rallies, meeting people in their neighborhoods, arranging talks, almost question and answer sessions. You have graffiti, you have word of mouth, SMS, telephone calls. People are talking about it. I mean, Sudan is also a country where people socialize around social occasions. And the fact that there had been so many wakes within the city for the 100 plus odd protesters who lost their lives on the 3rd has meant that people have had a lot of time to lick their wounds. And if the strategy of the junta was to instill some sort of a wall of fear, that hasn't happened.
Mohamed Hashim. Across the United States, feverish legal and political battles are being fought over a woman's right to have an abortion. Several states have passed legislation severely restricting a woman's right to choose. One state, though, Illinois, is making headlines for trying to fight against this movement, as our North America correspondent Aleem McBool reports.
We proudly proclaim that in this state, we trust women.
In the face of conservative gains on the issue nationally, the governor of Illinois, Jay Pritzker, announces the passing of a bill in effect reinforcing a woman's legal right to have an abortion here.
This room here is the room where they complete the surgical abortion procedures.
It's been of huge relief to those who give abortion care, like Jocelyn Gill from the reproductive health care provider Planned Parenthood.
It's very, very important just because there are surrounding states that don't have the privilege of providing those services. So now with a lot of these other states passing these laws or bills where they cannot receive these abortion services there, we have seen an increase in our patient flow from other states other than Illinois.
The laws Jocelyn's talking about are ones that have been passed in several states in recent weeks, severely restricting a woman's ability to have an abortion, some banning the practice at any stage of pregnancy. It's partly why Illinois felt it had to pass this counter law protecting a woman's right to choose. But many conservatives in Illinois were unhappy at that. The pastor leading the prayer during the debate on the issue inside the state house made his feelings very clear.
In this house, I pray for justice to roll down like water and righteousness like a mighty river.
With abortion, the consequence stays with you. And you have to question whether that's worth it. You ask me, no, it's not worth it.
Millions of dollars are now spent in the United States on campaigns to stop women having abortions. Some anti-abortion groups are run by women who themselves had pregnancies terminated and now say they regret it, like Nancy Cruiser.
I would just hope that abortion would be unthinkable.
She wanted her state to ban all abortions, not pass a law protecting the right.
The bottom line is it's a killing of a human being, of a baby. And now with it enshrined in our law, abortion through the ninth month, I cannot accept that kind of law.
There are circumstances where a woman's life or health could be in serious risk. The child's condition could mean that they don't have a good quality of life. There are no circumstances under which you think an abortion should be allowed.
No, and in my own particular experience, I remember often thinking, I have collaborated with the doctors in the murder of my own child. Of course, I accept differing points of view. My concern is when you embed this in a law.
So why has this become an issue across the country right now?
This is not new.
Paula Thornton-Greer of Planned Parenthood in Illinois has one way of putting it.
For 100 years, we've seen people or governmental entities, etc., that are against a woman's right to choose. There is a war against women in this country, and the commander of that war is sitting in the Oval Office right now.
Except, as we've heard, many American women support the moves to restrict access. It's made this one of the most important political issues ahead of the next election, and the battle lines are being drawn.
Aleem McBool reporting. Why do we care where we come from? Why do stories matter? Why do we like to have someone to blame? And why are we so fascinated by zombies? These are just a few of the questions that have been posed recently by The Why Factor. It's a podcast from the BBC World Service that looks at the things we do every day, often without thinking, and asks, why do we do that? The answers reveal extraordinary stories and hidden histories that'll make you think twice about objects and behaviours you take for granted. Just search for The Why Factor wherever you found this podcast. Why wouldn't you? The captain of a refugee rescue ship under arrest in Italy has said she disobeyed an order not to dock because she feared migrants aboard could take their own lives. Carola Rakita, who's German, could face up to 10 years in jail for breaking a year-old ban on migrant ships entering Italian ports. She's been speaking about her decision, as I've been hearing from our Europe editor, Mike Sanders.
She had an interview with the Italian newspaper Corriere della Sera, and she said that she really felt she had to disobey the order not to come into port. These migrants that she rescued on June the 12th, 53 of them originally, had been at sea for more than 2 weeks. And she said some of them, the remaining ones, the remaining 40 or so, had started self-harming. And she was worried that they would jump overboard to take their own lives because they can't swim. Now, she came into port. There was an incident where a police launch tried to get in between her as she was edging into the quayside and the dock wall itself. And there was a point at which they did touch, and it sped out again to avoid being crushed. And she did apologise for having touched the other boat, but she's vehemently denied claims by the Italian Interior Minister Matteo Salvini that she rammed the boat or was intending to put anybody's life in danger.
And what's the reaction been?
Well, there's been some reaction from German politicians now. Frank-Walter Steinmeier, who's the German president, went on television, and he conceded that, yes, OK, there may have been some breaches of regulations in terms of rules of the sea, but he said that, you know, somebody who saves lives can't be considered a criminal, and he said that Italy is a founding member of the European Union, and it's not just any old state, and he would have expected Italy to handle things a bit differently. Heiko Maas, the German foreign minister, has also come to her defence in similar sort of terms. Now, Matteo Salvini has told them both really to mind their own business and saying it's an Italian affair and Germany should keep out of it. He actually retweeted a social media post that suggested that Carola Rackete, this German captain, should get the Nobel Peace Prize. And he sort of put in an icon suggesting total incredulity. His opposite number as a deputy prime minister in Italy, Luigi Di Maio, he said, I don't understand why there's been an escalation in this war of words. He says it's a bit of a media circus. And I think that's where you're getting actually to the nub of the question, because it's a power struggle between Matteo Salvini and Luigi Di Maio and their two parties. Mr. Salvini's party, the League, has completely reversed the power balance with Mr. Di Maio's five-star movement in the European elections last month. And he's done so largely on the back of this decision he took a year ago to close Italy's ports to migrants. And indeed, it has brought down the numbers. Only 2,500 migrants coming into Italy this year, as opposed to 119,000 in 2017.
Mike Sanders. If you have the misfortune to live next to a noisy thoroughfare, the prospect of silent electric cars taking over the streets might seem a pleasant one. However, if you're visually impaired or unable to stop looking at your phone, that very silence could be a killer. That's why, from midnight tonight, all new models of electric or hybrid cars sold in the European Union must be fitted with an acoustic vehicle alert system. In other words, they'll have to produce a synthetic sound to warn pedestrians of their presence. Chris Valance reports.
A busy city street, dominated by the din of the internal combustion engine. But that soundscape is going to change as more of us switch to electric vehicles, like Jaguar's I-Pace.
My name's Ian Suffield. I'm an acoustics technical specialist for Jaguar Land Rover. We have designed the Jaguar I-Pace here to have a pedestrian alert sound. Electric cars obviously can be very low noise at very low speeds, which can be off-putting or, at worst case, dangerous.
Yes, so particularly if you're visually impaired or you've decided to spend all your time looking at your phone.
I was going to say, it's not just visually impaired. I'm as guilty as anyone of looking at my phone while walking around, and one day stood out in front of a particularly quiet car and thought, we need to do better than that.
The electric Jaguar's spacey sound is designed to alert people to its presence at speeds below 20 kilometres an hour. In already having this, it anticipated EU regulations that will require all new models of electric vehicles to have such a system. The sound doesn't come from the engine, but was designed by a team led by Ian Suffield.
So can we hear one of the early efforts at designing this? Because I guess you had to be careful not to make it too sort of flying saucer.
One of our sounds was particularly hovering UFO-like, and people looked in the wrong direction. they
looked
up
the sky
rather than looking where the where the car was. Right. So we ran a number of synthetic engine tests. And this is. We might use that as one of our layers, but I think that got a bit too futuristic. That right.
Yes, it was a little Doctor Who.
So that's quite electric. It's latent power, but it's quite useful in reflecting the fact that the car is purposeful and powerful.
People like Ian are, in effect, designing the future sounds of our streets. The challenge to create sounds that are quieter than an internal combustion engine, still sufficiently loud to alert pedestrians, and not vastly annoying when dozens of vehicles have them. That's what a road could sound like.
Could sound like, yeah, in the future with eye places going past.
Chris Valance. If you've ever had the time to wander around London, you may have noticed blue plaques on buildings across the city that tell you where, for example, Charles Dickens, Ian Fleming, or a host of famous statesmen, military leaders, and artists lived. The overwhelming majority of these plaques, which are also found in other towns and cities across the UK, celebrate men, and white men at that, which is why the unveiling of a blue plaque in the university city of Oxford yesterday is so unusual. It's dedicated to the Chinese artist, academic and poet Chiang Yi, who arrived in Britain in 1933 and died 40 years ago. Paul French, a specialist in modern Chinese history, is one of those who've pushed for the blue plaque to be erected.
Chiang Yi came from China to Britain in 1933 and he stayed here till 1955. And he wrote a wonderful series of books called The Silent Traveller. So there's The Silent Traveller in London, The Silent Traveller in Edinburgh, The Silent Traveller in the Lake District and The Silent Traveller in wartime. And these combine little poems and observations of English life from a Chinese perspective, along with the most wonderful sketches and paintings, which paint the English landscape or British towns, London, Edinburgh, Oxford, in a Chinese style with that kind of flat brushstroke. So it's a completely different eye on very familiar landscapes.
And when he came to England in 1933, he hadn't intended to stay.
No, not really. He came to teach a little bit. He wanted to do a master's at the LSE and perhaps a PhD. But he ended up remaining for a long time in London until the war and then eventually moving to Oxford.
And in Oxford, he didn't own a property. He lodged.
He was giving a lecture in Oxford and he started knocking on doors of people that had advertisements for, you know, lodgers. And the first house refused him. The second house refused him. And the third house, which was the Keane family, said, yes, you can have our front room. And he moved in there in 1940 and he didn't leave till 1955. 15 years he stayed there.
Has Chiang Yi ever had any recognition in the country of his birth?
Yes, he's very well known in the country of his birth. His books were all actually, although he was Chinese, he wrote in English, so they had to be translated into Chinese. And they were all published there. And he's lately had a revival, particularly his Silent Traveller in Oxford and Silent Traveller in Boston, because of the number of mainland Chinese students going to Oxford or going to Harvard, turning up and suddenly seeing this book about the town they've arrived in by a Chinese person written in the 1930s and thinking, what's that? So those books have remained in publication in Britain, but also have been translated and are well read in China itself.
Paul French speaking to NewsHour's Julian Marshall, who arguably deserves a blue plaque of his own. Millions of people have taken to the streets of New York to mark the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Riots, which launched the gay rights movement in the United States. There have been other gay pride marches in a host of cities around the world, but nothing came close to that of New York. Our LGBT correspondent Ben Hunt joined the marches and told me why the anniversary was so important to the world's gay community.
The Stonewall riots took place, as you said, 50 years ago. And what essentially happened was there was a gay bar called the Stonewall Inn, which is currently still standing. That bar was raided by the police. And in doing so, it really triggered the LGBT community to fight back. It was one of the first times that the community fought back against the police. And essentially, it started the modern LGBT rights movement. So a year after that Stonewall Inn was raided, America held its very first gay pride march, which is actually, it happened exactly where I'm standing now 50 years ago. So what we're seeing this weekend is a huge special anniversary of 50 years since that Stonewall uprising. And of course, New York has always been a major destination for LGBT pride festivals, but this weekend's events are set to be the biggest ever. Today, there are estimated to be around 4 to 6 million extra people on the streets of New York celebrating inclusion and equality. So it's a really great event to be at.
Goodness, 4 to 6 million, that really is huge. I understand, though, that there is some conflict, but yeah, incredible. Well done for counting them. There's some conflict, though, between the commercial pride, which you're at, and another march called Reclaim Pride. What's going on? What's this about?
Yes, so there are two very much dueling parades happening right now in New York. So, as you say, one of them is called Reclaim Pride. It's a heritage pride. So they're trying to remind people of the origins of pride and what they think pride should be. So it's not got any of the corporations involved. It's not got any corporate money. It's not got floats. It is just a very simple march through the town, which is very similar to what the pride originally was. What you're hearing behind me right now is the other pride. So that is New York Pride. And that is, I mean, it's humongous. I'm currently looking at the parade right now, and there are just streams and streams of people. We've got many, many different corporations represented here. You've got banks, you've got corporate offices, you've got government officials. There's also a strong police presence here. And for the other pride, the Reclaim Pride Queer Liberation March, there isn't a police presence as much because they didn't want police involvement. Because if you remember the original story of Pride, the LGBT people were fighting against the police, so they didn't want them to be present in that march.
Ben Hunt on the streets of New York. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.